You're listening to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. A very good Tuesday, everyone. I'm your host, Lori Boyer. Today on the show, California State Assembly member Heath Flora details the Problem Solvers Caucus's goals for California agriculture, and then a discussion with a Sacramento Valley grower who talks about the unprecedented possibility of receiving zero water deliveries and the long-term effects of this. I'll have a check-in of national news, but the show will kick off with regional news right after this word from our sponsor.
Sponsored by the California Walnut Board and Commission, delivering value to growers and handlers with advocacy, research programs, and walnut promotions. Doing more together.
In regional agricultural news today, another grape season has begun across the North Coast as warm spring weather has awakened buds on vines across the nation's premium wine region. With Arite comes another set of challenges for growers who have battled through drought and wildfires in recent years while harvesting smaller yields in the past two seasons. Last year's crop fetched a cash value of $1.4 billion combined for the counties of Sonoma, Napa, Mendocino, Lake, and Marin. The hurdles so far this year include a February frost that came at a time when some buds were already exposed because of mild weather, which made them susceptible to damage. And then there is drought. And a widening consensus among growers, the lack of rainfall is likely to result in another lighter harvest come August when picking begins for sparkling wine and continues into early November, depending on weather conditions. This year's crop, according to that thinking, may again be less than the historical average, which over the past 10 years has been at 477,237 tons crushed for the five-county region known as the nation's premier growing spot. Bud break has started about 2 weeks ago for Chardonnay vines, and the recent warm weather, including record heat, has spurred bud break in other varieties, including red grapes. The major concern right now is more rain is needed this spring to help replenish moisture within vineyard properties and its reservoirs, which were depleted last year by the drought. Just over an inch of rain has been recorded at Sonoma County Airport this year, about 7% of normal for what is typically the region's wettest months. Heavy storms in October and December put a dent in a rainfall deficit, but the latest U.S. drought monitor placed the county of North Coast in a state of extreme drought, the second highest category. And last year, the crisis forced some growers to let their vineyards go fallow and not be harvested. Hundreds of grape growers reliant on water from the Upper Russian River and its tributaries saw their water rights curtailed in an unprecedented series of steps by North Coast water regulators. Governor Gavin Newsom's April 2021 visit to the dry bed of Lake Mendocino, where he proclaimed a state of emergency, spotlighted wine country as one of the most deeply affected regions of the now three-year drought. Even relatively cooler weather parts of the region, such as the Petaluma Gap, have seen growing prospects diminished by the drought. And earlier this week, vineyards along the Dry Creek and Russian River valleys had soil that was visibly dried out, with cover crops already mowed, giving way to brown stripes between the vines. This year, California observed Ag Day on March 23rd, a day to celebrate the state's unique contributions to the nation's food supply, according to Assemblymember Maria Waldron. California has been recognized as the country's number one agricultural state for over 60 years, supplying about 50% of fruit, vegetables, and nuts. Ag Day is an opportunity to remind Northern California colleagues of this region's significance in maintaining agricultural leadership, according to Waldron. And according to the San Diego County Farm Bureau, San Diego County ranks as the 19th largest farm economy out of over 3,000 U.S. counties. They are the number one producer of nursery crops and avocados, number two in guavas, pomegranates, limes, and macadamias. They rank fifth in lemon production, nine in strawberries, and 10th in egg-laying hens. They also have more small farms under 10 acres than any county in the nation, and they rank number two in farms with women as a principal operator. Agriculture is a major contributor to the state's economy, and according to the 2019 crop report, California exported $21.7 billion in agricultural commodities around the world. Top commodities for export included dairy products, almonds, pistachios, grapes, along with cattle and calves. Less than 2% of the state's population is engaged in agriculture, yet each worker today feeds more than 165 people, compared to just 25 in 1960. In 1949, 22% of disposable household income was spent on food. Today, it is 11%.
Since agriculture is vital to the state and regional economies, they must do all they can to see that it flourishes, again, according to Waldron, including providing reliable and affordable sources of water. She is a member of the Bipartisan Rural Caucus, a group of legislators working to achieve consensus on issues facing California's rural and agricultural areas. She says that she will continue to do everything possible to support the irreplaceable agriculture industry. During Women's History Month and National Agriculture Week, California recognized the importance of women in agriculture with an official resolution introduced by Assemblymember Cecilia Aguiar Curry. With the support from American Farmland Trust, California passed the nation's first Women in Agriculture resolution. Women in agriculture represent an underutilized ally in the effort to navigate California's challenges such as climate change, farmland loss, and aging farmer populations. Though historically regulated to less visible roles in agriculture, women have always been critical to the success of the nation's farms and ranches. Increasingly, women are pursuing leadership roles as farm managers, farmland owners, and advocates for sound agricultural policies that provide real solutions to the industry's challenges. The resolution pointed to the importance of women in agriculture, including with women and girls now outpacing their male counterparts in 4-H and higher education programs related to agriculture. The future of agriculture is increasingly female. In 2017, women represented 37% of California's total producers, placing the state not even in the top 10 in the U.S. for its proportion of women producers. Women and farmers of color remain underrepresented in federal funding that supports conservation in California, with just 14% of Natural Resources Conservation Service practice incentive contracts going to white women and only 2% to non-white women between 2015 and 2020. Thursday, March 24th is to be designated as National Women in Agriculture Day. It was a bipartisan resolution supported by 55 senators. According to the resolution, National Women in Agriculture Day recognizes agriculture as one of the most impactful industries of the United States and acknowledges the countless women who help agriculture prosper both at home and abroad.
Sales of E85 fuel in California surged to a new record in 2021, jumping 55% over 2020 levels and nearly doubling since 2018, according to new data released by the California Air Resources Board. Last year, California drivers purchased nearly 62.5 million gallons of E85 flex fuel, a blend containing up to 85% of ethanol and 15% gasoline for use in flex fuel vehicles. That's up from about 40 million gallons in both 2019 and 2020 and 8 million gallons in 2018. The surge in California E85 sales has accelerated further in 2022 as record high prices for regular E10 gasoline are driving greater demand for lower cost, lower carbon alternatives. In recent weeks, E85 has typically been priced 30 to 50% below gasoline at stations across the Golden State. California is just one of a handful of states that reports annual E85 sales volumes, but Renewable Fuels Association President and Chief Executive Officer Jeff Cooper says it is safe to assume that California now leads the nation in consumption of low-carbon flex fuels.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236. Or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you.
Oftentimes, public issues such as improving infrastructure or reshaping education have become muddied by political barriers, resulting in these issues not being remedied in California. These barriers also end up affecting agriculture, including water and pesticide-related issues. The California Problem Solvers Caucus, modeled after the federal version, looks to bring politicians together from both sides to come to reasonable, mutual decisions on such issues, according to California State Assemblymember Heath Flora, who sits on the state's caucus.
There is a lot of us in both houses, both the Senate and the Assembly, as well as senators, Republican and Democrat, that want to work together, that we have a lot of good ideas, but we'd never really had a safe place to actually air out and talk through things that we all could commit to being, quite frankly, confidential. There's a lot of things that we talk about within those closed doors that are very aggressive. They're very personal. But to get to the, you know, the solutions, you have to have those honest conversations. So loosely, you know, it's obviously it's a group of Democrat, Republican senators, as well as assembly members. And it's a lot of fun to be able to have a group of colleagues that you absolutely trust and you can have open, honest conversations with and air your opinions out. And, you know, we as a caucus, we tend to present bills to each other on things that we like, whether they're ours or somebody else's, and try to get the rest of the caucus's support. And it's just it's a good group of people. And I think it's a great model that a lot of young, newly elected legislators should be very, very aware of. Because this idea that Democrats and Republicans can't work together is BS, and we have to move past that.
At the top of the California Problem Solvers Caucus's list is labor and water, both extremely complicated issues. Flora believes the Problem Solvers Caucus has a great opportunity to move forward with labor.
When you start talking about the building the trades labor organizations, that their members just want to build projects, working with their Democrats and Republicans that have very close relationships with them, we can build those alliances. You know, a lot of times Republicans, we tend to get hung up on prevailing wage and some of those issues, which is not a problem for me personally. I support prevailing wage projects because it's what we need to do to get these things done. It's just not a fight that I'm worth fighting. It's not a mountain I'm worth dying on. I would far rather put men and women to work, give them a workable wage, a livable wage, which gives them more expendable income, and they can move forward. So that is kind of one of those things that we just talk about within the caucus. Like, how do we come together and support these projects, working with our connections?
Another interesting focus of the caucus related to agriculture is carbon sequestration, an up-and-coming issue in the state with its climate goals.
I have legislation dealing with that. A couple senators have legislation dealing with that. And it's not like something that's super sexy, to be honest. Like, I mean, people don't think about carbon sequestration as being cool, but it's a huge issue for the state to meet our climate goals. And that's something that the Problem Solvers is going to engage in. And if we can tailor it and let the ag community. So where this all is kind of stemming from is UC Davis did a study on the urban areas. If they plant a bunch of trees or a particular type of tree, they get sequestration credits, right? They can get these offsets. Well, whether you're a permanent crop or you're almonds, walnuts, pistachios, cherries, whatever it may be, those are all trees. We plant roughly 150 trees to the acre. So why can't our farmers get those credits as well? And the environmental justice community tends to be very hung up on that because they don't want to give credits to the petroleum industry, right? So we're working with them and transitioning those credits for housing. So if you are a contractor, you need to buy offsets or get credits, you can go through and get credits from ag in that regard. So there's just a different way of looking at it, and we're excited about that. So those are a couple things that, as far as relates to ag, that the Problem Solvers are looking into.
Again, the most important quality of the California Problem Solvers Caucus is compromise, especially on an issue such as climate change, which Flora says is not even really disputed at this point.
What we try to do is if they are going to push legislation, we take like cap and trade, for instance, one of the first big pieces of legislation that I voted on, you know, when I first got up here. The Republican Party did not like it, but there was a lot of things that we negotiated very heavily in there with Governor Brown at that time. The engine tractor replacement program, you know, when guys are forced to buy new tractors to meet these tiering quality, you know, air quality standards, well, then let's give them the resources to go do that, right? And so that was something that we really fought hard for. So that's kind of that negotiation aspect. When legislation comes through, like, we're not going to push back. We can't just say climate change doesn't exist anymore. We're not, that is not the fight that we're fighting. What we're trying to make is it workable for the ag community. So that carrot versus the stick approach. If you're going to legislate on top of the ag world, give us the resources to make it successful and the time frame to be able to adapt. Because at the end of the day, if you take electrification, for instance, like everybody wants to electrify the entire grid, right? Whether it's EV vehicles and tractors and all this. Well, I'm sorry, like you cannot electrify a tractor right now. There is not a tractor that can actually, the technology does not exist. So what are we going to do in that meantime, right? And at some point, we have to have honest conversations about that. And that's kind of that void that the Problem Solvers is trying to fill, that bridge between the progressive left and kind of where reality is and how do we get there.
One thing that Flora, who has ties to California agriculture outside of the Problem Solvers Caucus, would like to see moving forward is the caucus tackle more issues related to pesticides and the outright banning of them.
We're working through that currently, so I would like to see the Problem Solvers engage on pesticide use and try to find a middle ground on some of those things. Because a lot of the pesticides that, you know, that we use and some of the stuff that we spray on, it's incredibly important to grow quality crops and make them safe for consumption as well. But we tend to lose that narrative in Sacramento. And a lot of it, honestly, is out of ignorance. It's not that these people like are actively, knowingly trying to hose us. They just don't understand. They don't know why we need to use these products. So it is very important that the ag community continues to stay engaged and help educate these folks. If you take a white guy from the Central Valley and, you know, try to educate, you know, I grew up differently from an urban LA member, right? Like, we have different backgrounds, we have different world views, and that's okay. But it's up to us to have those conversations and help educate each other on each other's issues. And that is the beautiful part about the Problem Solvers Caucus.
In national agricultural news, the United States and the United Kingdom reached a new Section 232 agreement last week regarding steel and aluminum imports from the UK. This agreement will provide opportunities to expand free and fair trade and strengthen a relationship with a great ally, according to U.S. Grain Council President and CEO Ryan LeGrand. He says the agreement lifts the retaliatory tariffs on more than $500 million of U.S. products. USGC also says this is a great opportunity because the U.K. is the fifth largest economy but produces less than 60% of its food needs. That makes it a potentially lucrative market for U.S. agriculture. It is vital for global economic development and the profitability of U.S. agriculture, according to LeGrand. The agreement is effective June 1st. U.S. policymakers are moving early to cushion an expected increase in world hunger fed by Russia's war on Ukraine. President Joe Biden acknowledged the problem at last week's NATO summit in Brussels.
We did talk about food shortages, and it's going to be real. The price of these sanctions is not just imposed upon Russia. It's imposed upon an awful lot of countries as well, including European countries and our country as well. Because both Russia and Ukraine have been the breadbasket of Europe in terms of wheat, for example.
House Ag Chair David Scott and his panel are calling on USDA and USAID to help.
We on the Agriculture Committee will be out front and doing all we can to make sure that we do not have a hunger crisis.
Former USDA Chief Economist Joe Glauber.
These big wheat importing countries are going to pay for wheat. We're going to draw down world stocks, come out of 22, 23, even tighter than we went in. But it's going to come out of the pocketbook of somebody. And that's probably going to be these governments that are going to try to keep bread prices and other things down.
President Biden is already committing aid.
We also talked about a significant major U.S. investment, among others, in terms of providing for the need for humanitarian assistance, including food.
$1 billion is already committed to Ukraine and another $11 billion over the next 5 years. The National Milk Producers Federation and the International Dairy Foods Association have submitted comments to the USDA's Food and Nutrition Service regarding dairy. The groups want the agency to improve nutrition security by updating school meal nutrition standards to encourage increased dairy consumption. That move would keep nutrition in line with the 2020 to 2025 Dietary Guidelines for Americans report with the leading health organizations. In 2020, the Federal Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee report found that more than three quarters of 9 to 13-year-olds are not meeting the recommended intake of dairy foods. School milk consumption has declined in recent years, particularly after whole milk and low-fat flavored milk options got removed from school meals 10 years ago. USDA can begin to reverse the trend through providing certainty for schools offering flavored milks, which provide the same micronutrients as white milk, but with a flavor that many children prefer, according to the groups in their comments. April 8th is the deadline for interested businesses, commodity organizations, and state agriculture departments to apply to be part of USDA's next ag trade mission. USDA Farm News reporter Rod Bain and Foreign Agricultural Service Administrator Daniel Whitley.
It is one of the major export sectors of U.S. goods to the United Kingdom. and soon the opportunity to expand agricultural trade to that market will be available via the latest USDA-led ag trade mission.
There's a lot of potential, a lot of brand familiarity with U.S. agricultural products, so we're excited and think our companies are going to do extremely well on this mission.
Foreign Agricultural Service Administrator Daniel Whitley says applications are now being accepted for the U.K. ag trade mission, scheduled for June 22nd to 24th, with representation expected to come from private business, commodity groups, and state departments of agriculture. The application deadline for the UK Ag Trade Mission is April 8th, with details available at www.fas.usda.gov/topics/trade-missions. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Senate Agriculture Committee Chairwoman Debbie Stabenow and Senator John Boozman, ranking member on the committee, say that they do have plans to write a new farm bill in 2023. The current farm bill expires September 30th of 2023. There have been rumors that Republicans don't want to write a new farm bill until after the 2024 presidential election. But Stabenow said the committee is still on track to write a 2023 bill and noted that there will be title-by-title hearings on the bill. Also, Stabenow says that they are not going to cut nutrition. She was reacting to a statement by Representative Glenn G.T. Thompson, ranking member in the House Agriculture Committee, who said that he would not rule out cutting the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program due to the mind-blowing amounts that the Biden administration has spent on nutrition programs, including the rewrite of the Thrifty Food Plan that led to a 21% increase in SNAP benefits.
The California Walnut Conference is back. Mark your calendars for April 7th and 8th at the Yuba Center Fairgrounds. This growing event has become the gem of Northern California Ag and brings walnut industry professionals together from across the Golden State. Be part of the experience and learn about new technologies, research, and meet with other ag insiders at the premier walnut conference in California. Register today at wcngg.com/events. The California Walnut Conference is powered by your top news resources in California, West Coast Nut, Progressive Crop Consultant, and My Ag Life.
For the past 30 years, George Tibbetts has been farming ground near Arbuckle that's been in his family since the early 1930s. He said his planting decisions are built around rice, with other row crops like safflower and wheat thrown in for rotational purposes. He also leases ground to a grower who produces processing tomatoes and vine seed. Tibbetts said his crop mix isn't necessarily set in stone, and he also considers market prices and weather conditions, among other factors.
I'm primarily a rice farmer, but as I learned in college and talking to old-timers, it's been known for years that when you rotate crops, it helps both of those crops. Well, it's a basic component of integrated pest management, IPM, crop rotation. Now, in practice, in California, a lot of the rice is not rotated because it's grown on very heavy clay soils that are great for rice, but poor for row cropping in general. However, in our particular area of Colusa County, our soils aren't quite so heavy, and that's a blessing. I consider that a blessing because we can rotate into row crops in and out. Particularly with the advent of transplanting tomatoes and drip irrigation, we used to, and I don't farm tomatoes, we've always had a tenant farmer come in and grow the tomatoes. And way back when I started farming, they were coming in and planting seed and sprinkling them, and the yields weren't that high because you're planting those little teeny tiny tomato seeds and heavy clay soil, and it was hard to have a precision planting operation going on with the tomatoes. But it was a good cash crop, and over time they've transitioned to transplanting the tomatoes and drip irrigation, and between those two things we've found that tomatoes can do very well on our farm, even though we also grow rice. I typically keep a field in rice for, I'll say, 5 years. It used to be 2 years, I'd go in and out, but it's a lot of work to take a field in and out of rice. So I stretched the length of time I typically keep a field in rice to about 5 years, sometimes a little longer, sometimes a little less. The markets will play a role. I'll look at the prospect of what crop prices are going to be for rice or other row crops, and that might influence my decision making from year to year. But for the most part, we try and just stick with a crop rotation and always have at least one field of tomatoes in the mix. We have 9 fields on the farm. farm, and always like to have one or two fields of tomatoes in the mix. And the tomato farmer also grows vine seed. So he'll rotate from tomatoes to vine seed and then back to tomatoes. So if it's out of rice for 3 years, we will, 3 or 4 years, we will have two crops of tomatoes and one of vine seed.
Tibbetts said he begins planning for the following year's crop the year before. But things don't always go according to plans, thanks to Mother Nature.
Well, we're always planning a year before. Of course, God laughs at our plans, or Mother Nature laughs at our plans. But as far as planning goes, just typically our crop rotation, are we taking a field out of rice? It doesn't always work out that I take a field out every year, but at least half the time we're taking a field out of rice, and consequently half the time putting a field back into rice. So 2 years ago, I took a field out of rice and got it almost ready for row crops, but rains came and messed that up, and I needed things to dry out, and they did dry out, and I was able to come in and finish making the beds, but then it never rained again, so I didn't have enough moisture to plant a row crop, so I had to go back into rice. So I did all that work to take a field out of rice and had to go put it back in. So that's one example of where planning can go awry.
Although rains in October and again in December buoyed hope for a somewhat normal 2022 crop year, the spigot turned off. Tibbetts Farms in Reclamation District 108, which has senior water rights to water stored behind Shasta Dam. The Bureau of Reclamation already has warned those with Sacramento River settlement contracts, as the water rights are known, to expect 0% deliveries this year. Some have put eventual water deliveries at between 0 and 30%. Tibbetts admitted that all of the unknowns definitely make it more difficult to plan this year. He said he won't know his ultimate water allocation for a few more weeks. Until then, he holds out hope.
We were aware of, after we harvested last year's crop, that input costs looked to be going up significantly. But also, the market prices for our crops were going up. So we were still planning on planting our normal crop rotation and just absorbing the additional costs and hoping that the additional revenue would offset that. But we knew we were vulnerable on the water situation, because last year we depleted Lake Shasta pretty well between farmers and cities and municipalities. And we knew that if it was just going to be a normal rainfall year, that we still would be short and there were going to be cutbacks on water deliveries. So we went into the fall and winter hoping for a lot of rain, and we got it. We got a tremendous amount of rain in October. We got a lot more rain in December. And so after that rain in December, we were well ahead of the curve as far as replenishing our water supply in Northern California. But then it flatlined, and we haven't really had any rain to speak of since December. And what started out as a good rainfall year, the curve flattened out, and now we're well behind. So we're behind on the rainfall we hope to get, and we started off in a deficit situation. So we're in unprecedented territory. I've heard powers that be talking about there's not necessarily enough water in Lake Shasta, for example, to keep the Sacramento River a river, even if no water is delivered to farmers. So they announced zero water for us, but they announced zero water for federal contractors last year too. But in our water district, we have a contract that says we in critical water years, we get a 75% supply. So we've had that happen many times. So last year we had 75% supply, but we can do things as far as recirculating water and jumping through hoops to get by with a 75% supply and still farm all of our crops. This year, there's no way they can honor that contract. The water simply isn't there. So we know we're not going to get even a 75% supply. We're waiting. We expect to find out in the next week or two what we're going to get. It could be zero. So I've heard the pessimists say 0%. I've heard the optimists say 30%. So maybe somewhere in between there, a 10 or 20% supply. I don't know. But yeah, it makes it very hard to plan. Fortunately for rice, we have crop insurance, specifically prevented planting insurance. So if we don't get the water to plant rice, my rice acres will be covered. So I will not be destitute. Thank God for the crop insurance. But our other crops are tomatoes and vine seeds and what have you. They don't have that provision for prevented planting. I'm really hoping for a 10 or 20% supply, because With that, we can still farm the tomatoes because that's very economical use of water, call it 2 acre feet plus or minus. And we can concentrate that little water we have onto our drip irrigated tomatoes. I will have no water left over for the rice, but I'll have crop insurance for that.
Calling the current drought unprecedented, Tibbetts said he has weathered dry periods before, but nothing like this. Like his fellow farmers, he is navigating uncharted territory.
This is unprecedented, completely unprecedented. We've had many critical, what they call critical water years over my 30 years of farming. I'll just guess in my 30 years, it's happened 5 or 8 times. And that's just the nature of the beast in California. It's feast or famine as far as water. We can go from droughts to extreme flooding. The so-called normal water year doesn't seem to happen very often. It's one extreme or the other. So we're in the drought phase right now, but we've been there before, but never to this extent, never to the extent that a very real scenario is that they will deliver no water.
Tibbetts is a member of Farmers Rice Cooperative, and he also sits on the board of directors. He said he is concerned about the drought's impacts on the co-op, but his concerns extend far beyond that to the farming community as a whole. That includes the tractor dealer, the fertilizer dealer, and all of the rice mills throughout the Sacramento Valley. Although reduced rice acres may temporarily bump up prices, he said in the long run it could price California rice out of the market. As a result, some buyers may turn to cheaper alternatives and never come back once California rice acres rebound.
I'm very concerned about the infrastructure we depend on to get through the year. As I mentioned, we have crop insurance that will keep us from going bankrupt this year because we still have a lot of expense, a lot of fixed costs, property taxes, keeping our labor force on the farm, even though we won't be farming. I don't want to let go my foreman, for example, who's been with me 20 years. If I didn't have any income, I would have to do that. But with crop insurance, I'll be able to keep them on. I don't know what I'm going to have them do all summer. I think we'll be cleaning our shop a lot and organizing things, which I've never been very good about. The whole infrastructure, the crop dusters, the crop consultants and PCAs, the fertilizer and herbicide dealers, all of those are going to get hurt badly from the loss of business. And they don't have insurance to cover that. And we need them to hang on. So when it rains again, hopefully next year, we can pick up where we left off and everybody get busy again. And when it comes to rice in particular, I'm very worried about the future of California rice from the standpoint is the price is so high for our commodity. I think California rice is the most expensive rice in the world right now. Our rice is very expensive. Now, yeah, that's a good thing if you're farming rice in California. So we're going to get a great price on the crop we harvested last year. This year, we can't take advantage of those prices because we're going to have so much fewer acres. The new normal in California for amount of rice acres every year is probably 500,000 acres. Let's call it a half a million. Last year, we were at 400,000 because it was a critical water year. Again, we're all speculating, well, how many acres are we going to have in California? It could be well less than 300,000. It could be 300,000 or a little more, but substantially reduced. So the price of our commodity is going to remain high, but it's in short supply. I imagine we will not be exporting very much rice from California to foreign countries. It will strictly be going to domestic use. But it's so expensive, we worry that some of our customers are going to switch to lower value alternatives, and maybe they'll grow to like it and won't come back. So I worry about losing long-term customers, and I worry about some of our export customers as well, like Japan. We've been shipping them a lot of rice for years, and if we don't bid on offers that Japan makes for us to ship them rice, they may say, well, you guys don't have the rice anymore. You're not a dependable supplier. And when we go back to full production, I hope that happens soon, there will be a precedent for them not living up to their obligation to buy a certain amount of rice from us from every year. So I worry about that. And then not just our cooperative, but all the rice mills in California, they're all scrambling for rice. We know there's going to be short acres, and they're going to be competing against each other to get as many acres as they can. So the grower who can grow a little rice is going to do very well, but there are long-term implications for our rice being priced too high, and I hope those don't come into play.
That will wrap up today's show. You've been listening to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Lori Boyer. From all of us here at the JCS Marketing Team, thank you for listening.